This PERspectives podcast is titled Dry Eye Disease and Novel Tear Stimulating Therapies, Optimizing Outcomes in Patient Subtypes. Joining me remotely, experts Selena McGee, OD, Jessica Steen, OD, and Laura Perriman, MD, talk about some of the more common questions regarding dry eye disease and its treatment. In this program, we focus on how dry eye disease affects postmenopausal women and those patients who wear contact lenses or are candidates for refractive surgery. Dr. Steen, let's start with the question that frames the rest of our conversation. Why use nasal stimulation to increase tear production?
Basal tear production can be increased by parasympathetic stimulation of the lacrimal functional unit. Now, the lacrimal functional unit includes the lacrimal gland, which when stimulated produces the aqueous component of the tear film. It includes goblet cells, which produce mucin, and it also includes the meibomian glands, which produce the necessary lipids to help to stabilize evaporation of the tear film. And the lacrimal functional unit also encompasses the nerves which innervate these structures. Stimulation of the anterior ethmoid nerve, either physically through the FDA-cleared external stimulation device or chemically through the FDA-approved varenicline nasal spray, leads to parasympathetic signaling along the trigeminal nerve through the trigeminal nucleus in the brainstem, where postganglionic fibers innervate the secretory glands of the lacrimal functional unit, which produce natural, complete basal tears.
Thank you for explaining that. So, Dr. McGee, what are some of the potential barriers to using a device for nasal stimulation?
The potential barriers for neurostimulation is the fact that it's different. I think that's the biggest barrier. And what isn't different is our patients are actually used to using nose sprays. They may not actually be used to using a device for stimulating their tears. So it's just really important for us to kind of get over that mindset that this is different, because the studies show and we see such an impact on patients when they have their own real tears being produced through the lacrimal functional unit. So don't let that hold you back when you are talking about technologies such as device, such as neurostimulation chemically. Either one, different, but highly useful. And I want to challenge you too to think about those patients where you don't want something on the ocular surface. Your glaucoma patients, they're already on a drop or multiple drops. Your patients that wear cosmetics, that they don't want to, you know, mess up things with a topical formulation, you know, anyone that wears a contact lens, these are all potential patients that we should explore a different way to address and give the patient their own real tears. So I do have a neurostimulation device in the office so that I can show patients how to use it. And then also with the nose spray, I always demonstrate how to utilize the medication. And it doesn't have to take a lot of time. In the beginning, you may think, oh gosh, this is going to take a lot of chair time and this is going to be hard for me to overcome. And it's really not. It's 10 to 15, maybe 30 seconds when you're talking to patients about this. So I would encourage you to have a demo device in the office for the neurostimulation, and then also just have, you know, a bottle of your varenicline solution so that you can show patients how to do these devices and medication through stimulating that anterior ethmoidal nerve.
Thank you, Dr. McGee. Dr. Steen, how frequently and for how long can a nasal spray be used for increasing tear production?
Dry eye disease as a chronic condition requires long-term treatment, so long-term safety and efficacy data is truly valuable. The varenicline nasal spray is approved for one spray in each nostril twice daily, approximately 12 hours apart. The phase 2 clinical trial, MYSTIC, demonstrated varenicline safety and efficacy through a 12-week period. Now, not specific to varenicline, but from a more general perspective, data from 2 non-randomized trials performed in the United States support the safety and efficacy of neurostimulation in increasing basal tear production through 180 days.
Thank you. Changing topics now, Dr. McGee, why do contact lenses increase the risk of dry eyes?
Our patients want to wear contact lenses comfortably, and they can as long as they have a sufficient tear film. And one of the biggest challenges is making sure that patients have their real tears and they need an ample tear film to keep that contact lens wettable so that they see well and it remains comfortable. And when you look at the data over the last 20 years, we see that contact lens dropout rates haven't really changed. And yet we have amazing technology. We have better use modalities, better solutions. And that should tell us that there's something going on the ocular surface. It's not the contact lens. And so I want to encourage us as a community to pause and address the tear film, because we know that that needs to be stable and we need an ample tear film to be able to keep that patient in their contact lenses comfortably and seeing well.
So is there a gold standard in treating dry eye disease in patients who wear contact lenses?
There really isn't a gold standard in treating a patient that wears contact lenses and dry eye disease, but I think our biggest challenge and what we should be thinking about is the mindset of, does this patient have an ample tear film to support the use of a contact lens? And there are ways to get there. And so I don't know that we have a gold standard, but it certainly is prudent for us to think about, okay, how can I address the ocular surface? And through neurostimulation, it lets us address the ocular surface in a very different way that doesn't disrupt what's already happening on the front surface with the contact lens. And it gives the patient wearing contact lenses their own real tear. And what's important about that is when you give a patient their own real tear, it has all of the components of our natural tear, which is mucin, which is the lipid layer, which is the aqueous layer that has, you know, over 2,000 different components to it. And so for us to put something on the front surface that may, you know, damage the contact lens, may adhere to the contact lens, may certainly not have the 2,000 ingredients that our natural tear has, this gives us confidence when we can utilize something that stimulates the lacrimal functional unit in a patient that's wearing contact lenses.
Thank you, Dr. Perriman. Is it important to establish basal tear production prior to refractive surgery?
That's a great question. And I think it's one of the metrics we should be looking at carefully prior to surgery, but it's probably not the only one. And there's a variety of reasons for that. Basal tear production is important in getting a quick vital sign check on the intactness of the lacrimal functional unit, which is important to know before you do surgery, before you go cutting into this lacrimal functional unit. The corneal nerves are the front line of the lacrimal functional unit that provides sensation signals to the brain, integrates the signal, and then sends commands to the lacrimal gland, the goblet cells, and the meibomian glands. So disrupting that front line, those corneal nerves, can be the equivalent of ripping the rheostat off the wall in the room that you're in. So I think it's important to know how the system is working at a baseline level, but it isn't the only thing we should be looking at preoperatively in these patients. I think we should also be looking at osmolarity and MMP9. And it turns out those are abnormal. Both of those metrics are abnormal in about half of our preoperative cataract patients, and 80% are positive in either one of those tests, osmolarity or MMP9. So just basal tear production alone is probably not quite enough.
So Dr. Perriman, how can untreated postoperative dry eye affect visual recovery and outcomes in refractive surgery?
So dry eye postoperatively is something we've all come across, and it's a disappointment for patients as well as for the doctor. So, you know, the dry eye before surgery can lead to errors in the direction magnitude of astigmatism. You can get errors in IOL calculations. When it comes to refractive surgery, untreated dry eye preoperatively can be more likely associated with enhancement rates, which is not good. Every time you lift that flap, you're disrupting the normal processes for the corneal nerves to regenerate into that flap. So it's something you really want to avoid. So postoperative dry eye can lead to epithelial disruptions, changes in keratometric readings, and you might be lifting a flap on a situation that really just needed dry eye management. So when we talk about enhancement rates for refractive surgery, I think it's very, very important to make sure the dry eye is under excellent control so that you're not chasing the wrong thing. So you're not lifting a flap and disrupting that corneal nerve subbasal plexus reinnervation of the flap unnecessarily, because we know that that leads to interesting problems down the road. So I think it's an important thing to identify preoperatively and postoperatively.
Looking at another population at high risk for dry eye disease, Dr. McGee, why is dry eye disease more prevalent in women of postmenopausal age?
Dry eye certainly in both sexes gets worse with more birthdays, but women particularly because of hormone changes and the change in the androgen hormones are more susceptible. And so women that are postmenopausal, when you look at the data, you know, typically it's around 75, 76% of our postmenopausal females are at risk for dry eye disease. And it typically, in my clinical experience, is a more recalcitrant type, and we have to be more aggressive. And part of that is because they go unnoticed many times for too long. We don't fully understand how all of the hormones work together and why that is happening. And you know, looking at topical hormone therapy, looking at hormone replacement therapy, we still don't fully understand what role that plays. We just know that it plays a role. And so we certainly need more research and more information to be able to help this special population. What we do know is if we can produce a patient's real tear postmenopausal, we have data around that. And we are able to stimulate their real tear so that they have an ample tear film on the front surface to help treat their dry eye disease. And so, again, while we don't know all of the information around how hormones change things, we know they do. And we have a solution that we can help our patients with by stimulating their own real tear, either through a mechanical device or through a chemical device. And you know, leveraging the own body to do what it's not currently doing.
Dr. Steen, how can intranasal treatment be a more convenient route of administration for women?
The convenience of an intranasal treatment, that is one that avoids the ocular surface, means number one, for those of us who wear contact lenses, we can utilize treatment with contact lenses in place. And as it's not an eye drop, we also don't have to worry about the same potential disruption to eye makeup as for topical ophthalmic preparations. And that's a benefit that's often underappreciated unless you've really been there.
We know that people with autoimmune diseases are at higher risk for dry eye disease. Which autoimmune disorders do you see most in your clinic presenting with dry eye disease?
The most common autoimmune disorders that I see in clinic are rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, and Sjogren's syndrome. Now, while we often think about dry eye disease being most pronounced in individuals with Sjogren's syndrome, it's also common in individuals with other forms of autoimmune dysfunction. And it's something to keep on our radar when we're reviewing a patient's medical history, even if they may not be reporting symptoms related to dry eye disease.
Dr. Perriman, why can trigeminal nerve stimulation be a particularly efficacious treatment for dry eye disease in patients with autoimmune disorders?
I love this question. So the autoimmune disease patient has a lot of inflammation involving different aspects of the entire lacrimal functional unit, including the nerves, the electrical wiring of the lacrimal functional unit. And those patients in particular really seem to respond positively to neural stimulation strategies, trigeminal neural stimulation strategies. And we have two FDA-approved methods at present. One is an intranasal chemical spray, and the other is an extranasal vibration device. And they both achieve the same thing in stimulating the lacrimal functional unit. So we offer this strategy a lot. in our autoimmune patients, in our postoperative patients, as a way of backdoor tapping into that lacrimal functional unit and addressing the neurosensory compromise of dry eye in those patients.
Thank you for joining me today to answer these questions about dry eye disease and those at especially high risk for this condition.